the Scottish preacher, some time ago wrote a striking paragraph that I've seen printed a number of places in a little work called Why the Sea is Boiling Hot. He said, "I'm recovering the claim that Jesus was not crucified in a cathedral between two candles, but on a cross between two thieves, on the town garbage heap, at a crossroads so cosmopolitan that they had to write his title in Hebrew and in Latin and in Greek, or shall we say in English, in Bantu, and in Afrikaans, at the kind of place where cynics talk smut, and thieves curse, and soldiers gamble, because that is where he died, and that is what he died about, and that is where churchmen should be, and what churchmanship should be about." The thought that Jesus was not crucified in a cathedral between two candles, but on a cross between two thieves, is, I think, a rather striking way of saying that we may have missed a bit of the tartness of his call to discipleship. If you look at church history, you get the impression almost uniformly that a great deal of influence is flowing out from the followers of Christ to the world. But I think if you look at history and at our lives carefully, you'll see that the reverse is often true as well. That at least in many periods of church history, there is as much influence flowing from the world into the church as there is the other way around. A few Sunday nights ago, we talked about some of the gods of modern man. Gods like mammon, success, materialism in general, making goods to serve as the good, making means to serve as ends. When this kind of thing is transformed into the life of the church, or transferred into it, a strange twisting of values takes place, and we may be almost unaware of it happening. We begin to evaluate the church in terms of its size, the grandeur of its building, the popularity it has in a given community, and may not have a very clear picture of what the church really is supposed to be about. Waldo Beach suggested in a recent book on the Christian life that it would be interesting to have a number of pulpit committees honestly state the priority between two questions when they're looking for a new preacher. Is he a go-getter? Is he Christ-like? We really have a way of judging our success much as we judge the success of everything else. And that doesn't seem in this story out of the Gospels to be the way Jesus judged his success. The kind of requirements he stated for people, the willingness he showed for men and women to make their minds about whether they would follow him at all costs or whether they would not, is something we have to recover constantly if we're going to be true disciples of his. It isn't an unusual thing, you know, to see on bulletin boards in front of buildings or just in bulletins a little sign that says, "Church of Christ, air-conditioned, worship and comfort." And we don't even seem to be amused or embarrassed that our appeal is so often out of kilter with the cross under which all of this stands. There is such a thing as cheap grace, that is, offering the forgiveness of God, offering the supper, baptism, offering the consolations that religion, Christianity can bring at a very cheap cost. Peter Berger, who is one of the best-known sociologists today, has commented that if you were to examine the values of people who call themselves Christians alongside the values of other people who do not in our country, you would probably conclude that the values are largely the same. They're just held with more tenacity or fervor by Christians. I'm not sure that Berger's judgment is infallible in the matter, but I think there's a frightening possibility that he may be too nearly right. That is, that we have settled for respectability in the community, that we haven't really gone for any kind of drastic step in following Jesus Christ. And that introduces the importance of a text like the one you've heard read tonight. When Jesus issued the call, "Follow me," he was challenging people to take up a commitment that isn't a superficial thing. We've lots of commitments. I'm pretty well committed during football season to a team here or there, or during basketball season in the same way. But that commitment is a rather superficial one, and it isn't hard to see fans turning away if there's a lack of success for a week or two straight. I'm fairly prone during a political campaign to change my allegiance a time or two before I get inside the voting booth, and sometimes after I get inside, because the commitment is often not very deep to a given person. I'm not really sure I know that much about the person who's running for the office. What Jesus was calling for was a considerably deeper commitment than that. Something that would not just change our way of thinking about a few things or cause us to accept a few things about him, but something that would change our whole style of life. In Judaism in the first century, to follow someone was an almost technical term. It had come from the word in Greek meaning road, but it carried with it a deeper meaning than just road or following a road. It carried with it the meaning of commitment, of taking up a whole new way of life and not just changing one's way of thinking about a few things. Once that's appreciated, you can understand the sternness Jesus had when he sometimes issued that call, follow me. Matthew has an account in Matthew 8th chapter of the same thing Luke records in the 9th chapter, which was just read to you. Beginning with verse 18 of Matthew 8, he shows Jesus issuing his call to various people, and one of them responds that he will follow Jesus, and Jesus gives the warning, foxes have holes, birds have nests, I don't have anywhere to lay my head. He seems to be saying, are you following me for a kind of easy security? You should realize that that may be the very thing you'll lose following me. You may find yourself running afoul of the authorities, going against the grain of public opinion. You may even find yourself being persecuted if you follow me. You'd better realize that I don't have any security of the kind men ordinarily are seeking. I don't have any place to lay my head. Another person said, Lord, I'll follow you, but let me first go bury my father, implying that his father was dead and the funeral hadn't taken place. Jesus said, let the dead bury their dead. You go preach the kingdom of God. Evidently meaning, let the person who's dead to my call bury the person who's physically dead, because you have a higher work to do. Nothing should come between you and doing it. There's a sternness about that call. I've often thought that if I were being called to follow someone or to take a new job, and the person for whom I propose to work won't even allow me to stay for my father's funeral, I wouldn't have any interest in working for him anyway. It is a stern call that Jesus issues. But Matthew tells us something else. Luke includes the case of the person who wants to go back and tell his parents goodbye, very much like Elisha when Elijah dropped the mantle on him. Elijah's work was coming to an end, and he chose Elisha to be his successor. Elisha knew what the mantle meant, but he said, first, let me go kiss my mother and father goodbye. He did, offered a sacrifice, and then went with Elijah. This man seems to want to do the same thing, but Jesus says, if you put your hand to the plow and then look back, you aren't fit for the kingdom. His is a more stern call than Elijah had issued to Elisha. The next paragraph in the Gospel of Matthew says, and Jesus went into a ship, and his disciples followed him. Now there's our key word. Matthew has given his command, follow me, and now he gives the next paragraph where they're following him. You may recall what happened when I mentioned it. They got into a boat to go over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and a great storm came up, and it looked like they were going to be destroyed. And it seems to be Matthew's way of telling us that as quickly as the disciples accepted the call to follow him, first few steps were pretty easy. Getting into a boat, going on a voyage, perhaps finding a new environment, adventure. But not very long afterward, they found themselves in the eye of a storm. In Luke 14th chapter, Luke gives the same kind of call by Jesus. Here he says, great multitudes are going after him. And Jesus turns and says, if any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and his own life too, he can't be my disciple. Well, Jesus never taught anyone to hate another person in terms of ill feeling or bitterness. But in the sense of loving less, and the contrast being so sharp that one seems to be hatred in contrast with the love of the other, he did make his demand. It's the sternness of that call to discipleship that makes us stop and ask, can we follow Jesus today? The first thing I wanted to do was underline what it meant to follow Jesus in the first century. It was a serious call. To follow him meant leave your business, leave your family, leave your whole investment in life, and take up an entirely new way of life. And that doesn't seem to be exactly what I've been called to do. I can keep so many of those things and still be his disciple that it gets uncomfortable to compare my following with their following. And one begins to struggle with the question, with his ideals pitched so high, can I really follow Jesus today? Is there a way that I can take up that road, not even knowing where it leads, and be true to it? What does it mean to me in the here and now to follow him as they were called on to follow him? I want to suggest about three things that I believe it means. One of those things is that Jesus has a plan for life, and following him means accepting that plan wherever it leads. In the 21st chapter of the Gospel of John, we have a story of the appearance of Jesus to the disciples after his resurrection. And Jesus called on Peter to confess him three times, as he had denied him three times on the night of his death, or night before his death, night of his betrayal. And Simon Peter responded with a bit of irritation, Lord, you know that I love you, and kept affirming and reaffirming his love. When that was all finished, Jesus told him the time would come when he would be led to go to a place that he didn't want to go. He was speaking to him of the death he would die. He would be bound and led away. Simon Peter did a very human thing. He raised a question about John. If that's going to happen to me, what's going to happen to this other disciple? At least that will get Jesus off him for the time and get him thinking about somebody else. And that's when Jesus answered rather tartly, if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? But then it's the next thing that comes. If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? Follow me. We're back to our word again. A little earlier when he had said this to show what death he was going, or by what death he was going to glorify God. When you were young, you girded yourself and walked where you would. But when you're old, you'll stretch out your hands and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish to go. After this, he said to Peter, follow me. In that day, it was a rather stern requirement. He had a plan for Peter's life. And that plan was going to lead to martyrdom, and Jesus knew it. But he called him, follow me. Take up my way of life. In this official way, commit yourself to the plan I have for your life. When Simon Peter, in a very human fashion, says, what about somebody else? Jesus says, if I'm willing that he stay around till I have the second coming, what business is that of yours? Follow me. A second time he demands it. Sometimes accepting this plan brings a good many things that we really would rather not have come our way. In modern times, there was a play a few years ago called The Deputy, and a man named Roth Hakuth set out to depict what he thought was the failure of Pope Pius XII, the man who held that position during World War II, ever to speak up against the mass genocide the Nazis were effecting against the Jewish race. There were people on one side saying, you're too spiritual, keep out of this, keep the people who follow you completely away from it. And there were people on the other side saying, but you know some Jews have been converted, and at least you ought to speak up for their benefit. But Pius XII kept his silence. And the play about that silence was a very controversial play. But in the play, Hakuth has a young priest named Ricardo put the Star of David on his vestments and walk into a gas chamber with a bunch of Jews to die. He explained to his abbot what he was doing and why in the play. To look on idly when tomorrow morning our fellow citizens are loaded aboard cattle cars. Are we to stand by, wave our handkerchiefs to them? That is, if the kind Germans permit. And then we go home, confess. What should we confess? That we use the name of God in vain. And sit down to some journal and read about the excavations at St. Peter's. And then on Sunday we ring the bells and celebrate our Mass, so filled with sacred thoughts that nothing surely tempts us to consider those who at that very moment in Auschwitz are being driven naked into the gas. One man's way of saying there's a time when a person who has any influence at all needs to speak up, take his stand, however unpopular it may be. That's the story of the Old Testament book of Daniel. Daniel is called on not to pray, but three times a day that window opens toward Jerusalem and he prays. He knows what the king has said. He knows what may follow. He winds up in a lion's den, but he prays. The three Hebrew children find themselves in a similar situation. There's a statue to be worshipped, and they aren't going to worship it. They know very well what may happen, and they wind up in a fiery furnace. But the call, follow me, involves making the choice. That's what I'm trying to say. I don't know where the choice comes in your life. Sometimes I have difficulty telling where it comes in mine. But I do know that when the choice is there, it has to be made, because follow him in the New Testament is not something superficial. It's something that may very well hurt. In 1939, a young man, young German, was pacing the streets around Times Square. Long evening of decision. Some friends had gotten him an invitation to come to America and teach. Now he could stay far away from what Hitler was doing. But in his struggle, he decided he couldn't. And Bonhoeffer went back and joined the forces against Hitler, knowing what would happen, and it did. He was eventually imprisoned and executed. But he became famous for a number of things, one of which was a statement that he lived by. When Jesus bids a man come, he bids him come and die. It takes a whole lot of commitment to lead that kind of life. Recently on Herald of Truth, we've been going back for 1976 programs and trying to uncover some religious decisions that were made in the last part of the 18th century, 200 years ago in America, to try to show that there were not just political decisions being made, there were serious religious decisions being made as well. And among the things we've uncovered have been stories of pioneer preachers and their families separated for months from each other, diaries, letters to and from, indicating the hardship a wife is undergoing while the children are ill and she's ill and the husband is away preaching in this place, and this one, unable to afford the visit home. The hardship people have known and the comfort we have is quite in contrast. We have to face honestly, what is the plan he has for my life? A second thing that following him today means is that we have to accept whatever future he lays before us. I'm impressed with the fact that in the Gospels, Jesus talks very little about the past. It's not so much a question of what you've done as what you're willing to do that Jesus seems to be interested in. It is not so much whom you've wronged as whom you're willing to help in the future. So when people come to him with pasts that we would have to sit down and discuss perhaps for a very long time, Jesus demands that they begin from here and face the future. A woman is brought who's taken in adultery in the very act. He raises no questions about the circumstances or how she ever happened to be in such a situation as that. He simply says, go and sin no more. Nicodemus comes, bound hand and foot in Pharisaic legalism. I think I would have been curious to know, how did you ever get in the situation you're in? How did you ever get so bound by tradition that you thought everything was fine just because of who you are and the way you were born? Jesus does none of that. He simply says, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. The whole story of the prodigal is a kind of paradigm of the way God saves men. And the prodigal, you remember, made his speech and memorized it. He was going to say to his father, I've sinned against heaven and before you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me one of your hired servants. He didn't get very far until his father had demanded that a robe be brought and a ring and shoes and his whole status returned to him because he was interested in the future. even though I might have dwelt a long time on the past. It's easy to forget that even though we fail, what he's interested in is from here on. And he still has a couple of hands, one of them to help us up and one to point the future. Following Jesus means to take the plan he has for life seriously. To be open to the future he lays before us. And it means a final thing. It means to imitate the example that he left for us. I think people who take it seriously find the greatest difficulty at this very point. Jesus was single. He never married. He didn't have a family or the obligations one brings. He didn't have a household of his own. He didn't find it absolutely necessary to work in daily menial tasks to support himself. How can I live the kind of life he lived? But I think to get caught up in those facets of his life is to miss the central point of him as example. He left as an example. He did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, Peter says in 1 Peter 2. Something is there for me to imitate. I'm called on to imitate the commitment of his life. The direction by which he made decisions, rather than the things that are more superficial, whether he had a household of his own, whether he lived in a complex industrial society like ours. Don't get so bogged in the contrast between a world of ICBMs and the world of rural pastoral life he lived in that we miss the point that it's the quality of life, the commitment to the Father's will that has to judge in either place. He served in the best possible way. That was always his commitment. Someone put that thought in a little poem called Listen Christian. His name is Bob Rowland. I don't know anything else about him, but he impressed me with his poem. I was hungry, and you formed a humanities club and discussed my hunger. Thank you. I was imprisoned, and you crept off quietly to your chapel in the cellar and prayed for my release. I was naked, and in your mind you debated the morality of my appearance. I was sick, and you knelt and thanked God for your health. I was homeless, and you preached to me of the spiritual shelter of the love of God. I was lonely, and you left me alone to pray for me. You seem so holy, so close to God, but I'm still very hungry and lonely and cold. Thank you. Somehow it's hard to put action to the purposes we make. Jesus calls to a life following his example. And that example was not one which just analyzed and felt sympathy. It was one which acted and which got involved. Now, I don't mean a sermon of condemnation. I think I have the privilege of talking to some of the best people in the world. But I do mean that there's some growing to be done and that no one of us is home yet. Simon Peter in Luke 5th chapter saw Jesus coming to him and felt unworthy, and he said, "Depart from me. I'm a sinful man, O Lord." At Caesarea Philippi, the same man with a great deal of boldness said, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." Something has happened. In the first case, he doesn't understand Jesus. He's afraid of him because of the miraculous power he has and says, "Don't come close to me. I'm unworthy." In the other case, he knows who he is and is still perfectly willing to be in his presence. And as we can best tell, about 2 years had transpired between the two events. Simon Peter had done some growing, some changing, and it had brought him to a willingness to be with Christ, even though he fully realized who he was. Follow me. What would he be doing if he were here? That's what you and I have to look for. Remember the Old Testament story when Absalom led the coup d'etat against his father? He was announced king at Hebron, and that's not far from Jerusalem. And King David knows that his son has so many leaders in David's army defecting to him that life is endangered in Jerusalem. It may just be a matter of time until they're all wiped out. And so he issues the call, "Let's leave Jerusalem. Otherwise, we'll all fall before the edge of the sword." There was a man named Ittai from Gath, who'd been a friend of David's for some time, but he wasn't related to him. He wasn't an Israelite. He had no reason to stay with him and risk his life when Absalom is following David, trying to kill him, and would be willing to kill everybody else around him. So David tries to send Ittai away. He's a little-known character. But here's what he said. As the Lord lives, and as my Lord the King lives, wherever my Lord the King shall be, whether for death or for life, there will your servant be. And Ittai went with him. It's a beautiful thought, if it can just take flesh in our lives. As the Lord lives, wherever you are, in life or death, that's where I'm going to be. We can follow Jesus today, but it isn't easy, and it won't be. It calls for an openness to His plan for our lives, an acceptance of the future as we meet it in His service, and a willingness to follow His example at whatever cost. Gospel obedience is such a small part of all of that, but it's the necessary beginning. Do you need to come while we sing?
Where thou art in glory, there shall